Blog Talk Radio.
On Wednesday night, we always concentrate on union stuff. And this is a comment on where the president gave his speech. And the title of this is, "Sorry, Mr. President, Amazon isn't the place to go for good jobs." So let's read what. And this was in Chattanooga?
Yeah, this is the one where I saw people look like they were ready to jump him.
Well, in his speech in Chattanooga, Tennessee yesterday, President Obama rightfully called out for an increase in jobs that pay high wages and offer good benefits, what he called middle-class jobs, and for a focus on creating manufacturing jobs. Well, those are all laudable goals. Obama chose to give a speech about these topics at the Amazon Chattanooga Fulfillment Center, a location that neither pays those good wages and benefits, nor is a place that offers manufacturing jobs. According to various reports, many of the 15,000 jobs at the 70-plus warehouse around the world pay $12.50 an hour. Most workers have no health care unless they pay for it themselves or paid leave. Full-time employees do have health insurance and 401k funds and get stock shares, but most employees are not full-time. Work conditions at the fulfillment center are widely reported to be horrible. Workers report walking 10 miles or more on the average day, often in blistering heat. Workers were regularly sent to the emergency room after working in temperatures that sometimes exceed 110 degrees. Morning Call reported that at least one location hired a paramedic to wait outside closed warehouse doors to treat employees who fainted or were suffering from dehydration. Productivity is tracked by scanner databases that automatically issue demerits, regardless of how bad working conditions got in the warehouse. If it got too hot, employees can choose to leave, but the computer gives them demerits for doing so. Oh, my God. Enough demerits would lead to firing, and the only way around the heat-related demerits was a doctor's note and a medical waiver from the warehouse managers. A doctor's note is a little hard to obtain when you don't have paid sick days to visit a doctor, don't have insurance, and can't afford a doctor on your low salary. Workers are pressured to keep up dangerous levels of work for shifts that last 12 hours or more. Workers say they are constantly in fear of being written up or fired for not working fast enough. Employees reportedly have to participate in phone conferences where there was screaming and constant complaints that production numbers weren't high enough, regardless of how high they were. Several former managers said they were retaliated against for complaining about work conditions. The Seattle Times reported that a Kentucky warehouse, workers were pressured not to report injuries to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. A Pennsylvania worker filed a lawsuit after allegedly being told to lie about a workplace injury. Also, the warehouses have such elaborate security procedures to prevent employee theft that leaving work can be a 25-minute unpaid ordeal. Employees filed a class action lawsuit against this practice. As for manufacturing jobs, Amazon fails on that aspect too. By their nature, manufacturing jobs in the United States have traditionally paid well and had good benefits, which we've already seen don't apply here. But manufacturing jobs are supposed to be permanent jobs as well. Manufacturing jobs offer job stability, where you know that if you work hard, you'll always have a job. But that's not how Amazon works. According to Morning Call, many of Amazon's fulfillment center jobs are temporary jobs hired through Integrity Staffing Solutions. Oh, boy. By hiring the workers as temps, they can, of course, be paid less and not given benefits. But more importantly, it means there's no job security. Amazon reportedly offers the best workers permanent positions, but workers report that isn't the way things usually happen. Normally, after a designated number of hours, the job expires. A few are given permanent jobs, but most are let go and have to apply again a few months later. The permanent job carrot is dangled in front of temporary workers to get them to work harder and harder until the job ends. People quit or they get injured. Morning Call was told that the turnover rate was very high at fulfillment centers. Oh, wonderful, that one's coming to Connecticut. Another key for manufacturing jobs is the right to organize and collectively bargain with management. The Seattle Times notes that unions are unwelcome at Amazon. Early on, Amazon took a hard line against unions, a high-profile organizing effort by the Communication Workers of America at an Amazon call center in Seattle ended in 2001 when the center was shut down and some 400 workers were laid off as part of a larger company restructuring. Fulfillment centers workers say they were forced to attend a meeting once a year where the company would denigrate unions and warn employees against joining them. The use of largely temporary workforce also undercuts union organizing efforts. Since the workforce is constantly changing and few workers are there long enough to participate or lead organizing efforts. So while it's laudable that the president is pushing policies that would expand good jobs, he should pay a little more attention next time where he's giving such a speech and make sure the company he's gracing with his presence isn't part of the problem. That's disgraceful that he would go and speak at a place like
that. Isn't that something?
What a complete boob he is.
Who set up his agenda is out of his mind.
Yeah, stupid. That shows the quality of the people he has around him.
Interesting.
And then they have teacher layoffs in Chicago. Chicago teacher layoffs, unnecessary and shameful. This is my call. Let me see what it says here. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has targeted Chicago teachers again, this time with an announcement last week that Chicago Public Schools will lay off more than 3,000 teachers and school staff. This comes on the heels of the city's closing of nearly 50 schools and layoff of some 850 educators. Along with the layoffs, steep budget cuts are in the works. Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis says, The loss of teachers and support staff will have a direct impact on the quality of instruction offered in our schools under the imposed longer school day. These cuts are unnecessary and shameful for a system that prides itself on providing a high-quality education for our students. While the mayor is busy making multi-million-dollar stadium deals in the Illinois General Assembly is playing volleyball with workers' lives, our students are the ones suffering. That's sad. In addition to the layoffs of the experienced teachers and budget cuts, the Chicago Public School has awarded a $1.6 million contract, Teach for America, to bring in 325 recruits in quotation marks, and another 270 teacher interns in quotation marks with just one year's experience. Writing in the online magazine Jacobin, Chicago educator Kenzo Shibata says, "Why would the Chicago Public Schools throw more money into recruiting recent college graduates with 5 weeks of training and no teacher certificates into the district when it lets go of highly qualified, certified veteran teachers?" That's a good question.
Yeah.
And if I were one of those highly qualified older teachers, I'd be suing for discrimination.
I think so.
Gender equality. The Unfinished Business of the Labor Movement, and this is by Tula Connell of the Solidarity Center Global Action. Women at every level are moving the labor movement in new directions and inventing new kinds of worker organizations and new ways of being a trade union, says labor historian Dorothy Sue Cobble. Cobble, a distinguished professor of history and labor studies at Rutgers University, was among several speakers opening a two-day AFL-CIO Solidarity Center conference this morning, Women's Empowerment, Gender Equality, and Labor Rights, Transforming the Terrain. Nearly 100 labor and community activists from 20 countries are gathered here in São Paulo, Brazil, to share strategies for achieving gender equality and workers' rights in their unions and workplaces. Let's see what else they're doing there. Gender equality is the unfinished business of the labor movement, said Solidarity Center Executive Director Shawana Beta Blau in the conference's keynote speech. The strategic exploitation of women workers for the economic gain of business is one of the key global dynamics driving down wages and working conditions and keeping people from their rights across the globe. If we want to stem the unrelenting race to the bottom, we must fight for workers at the bottom of the supply chain, starting with women. Whoops. My glasses just fell here, folks. I don't know if I can find them.
Can you find them?
No, the problem is I can't see. Just a second, folks.
You have them in your hand.
Well, that's one thing. But I have another pair.
Okay.
So...
Oh, sorry, folks. Okay, go ahead, Bob.
So, sorry.
Continue.
I have to put my glasses on. I have two pairs of glasses, one for reading close and one for reading far. But I didn't want Leo to step on them. That's why it was such a big deal. Three Brazilian trade union leaders described their efforts to make gender equality and women's issues central to their unions and part of legislative priorities. We have fought very hard, we Brazilian women, to take up the spaces of power, said Maria Axeldora dos Santos, women's secretary at Forca Cinedel. We have to say men will not speak in our name. More than 100 women live in Brazil, yet they hold only 13.7% of executive positions and are only 22% of management. But over the past 10 years, the Governing Workers' Party has enabled women to make tremendous gains because of the focus on alleviating poverty and improving the economic conditions. Gertrude Meswini, National Gender Coordinator for the Congress of South Africa Trade Unions, shared how women unionists pushed for the creation of a full-time gender coordinator position and gender coordinator chairperson throughout the Congress of South African Trade Unions. A conscious effort was made to build an active gender structure. The Federation also integrates gender issues in collective bargaining and wages and campaigns in a variety of issues critical for women, including the prevention of workplace sexual harassment and violence and the creation of child care facilities. Sally Choi, Project Coordinator for the Hong Kong Congress of Trade Unions on China and International Affairs, discussed that union's recent victory in moving the government toward improving the nation's workplace sexual harassment laws so that women in service and retail jobs are covered. An organizer and a researcher, Choi, has coordinated gender and labor programs in mainland China and has been active in the local women's movement in Hong Kong for 10 years. As Cobble summed up the conference goal, our challenge over the next 2 days is to think about how to sustain these new efforts, to learn from and spread their wisdom, to capture their stories and let the world know that women, labor women, will not and are not being silenced. So that's good. What do you have over there, Leo, on do you have any labor issues over there where you're
looking?
Not
really. No, just a lot of national news.
What else I have?
I
the AFL agrees with France. It's high time to stop the secrecy around the U.S.-European trade union negotiations.
Yeah.
That might be interesting. Here, why don't you read this one, Leo? Not too long. On Monday, July 29th, France's Trade Minister Nicole Bricq called for increased transparency in the U.S.-EU trade negotiations, also known as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, through a statement to the French newspaper Liberation. Is that on? Is that on?
Yes.
Okay. According to Reuters, Bricq revealed that she has made the request to the European Trade Commissioner Carl, I can't really pronounce his name, so the European Trade Minister, to open up European Union's negotiation mandate to the public, stating that it doesn't contain any secrets. It's a political statement that calls for an agreement that respects our values and interests. It deserves to be debated. If the talks with the United States are for partnership, and if we are working as equals, then our practices need to change so that we speak the same language. The AFL-CIO has continuously advocated that trade agreements and U.S. trade policy reflect our values by securing basic labor rights for all workers while promoting economic growth with equity. Without transparency, there is no chance for public discussion of these critical issues. Even though the trade agreements affect our workplace rights, the food we eat, and the public services we all use, nothing is made public until decisions have been made and agreements have been signed. This model of secrecy has blocked the general public from input for extremely important trade negotiations that have cost millions of U.S. manufacturing jobs, allowed for trade benefits for repeat human rights violators, allowed global corporations to challenge social and environmental protections in undemocratic tribunals. This is not the model of trade our working families deserve or need. Transparency can only be the first step. By opening up the negotiations, the AFL-CIO is optimistic that trade policy can be conducted in a way that protects workers and promotes shared prosperity in the global economy. The U.S. government should pay attention to these efforts and respond by opening up its negotiating efforts and other trade agreements. Democracy only works when citizens know what their government are doing. Please watch out for continued updates and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement as negotiations continue. We'll need your help to make sure our legislators and the administration know that workers and families care about trade negotiations and that they must be done right.
Yeah. Back in March, actually a year ago, which is really weird, and somebody just published this for me recently. I wouldn't doubt if I read this last year, but I think it's important for people to know why there isn't more protests going on nationally.
Uh-huh.
Well, only days, this was back in March of last year. Only days after clearing Congress, U.S. President Barack Obama signed his name to H.R. 347 on Thursday, officially making it a federal offense to cause disturbance at certain political events, essentially criminalizing protests in the United States. Russian television broke the news last month, which was March of last year, but the Congress had overwhelmingly passed the U.S. House of Representatives after only three lawmakers voted against it. On Thursday this week, President Obama inked his name to the legislation and authorized the government to start enforcing a law that has many Americans concerned over how the bill could bury the rights of assembly and protest as guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. Under H.R. 347, which is more commonly been labeled a trespass bill by Congress, unknowingly entering a restricted area that is under the jurisdiction of Secret Service protection can garner an arrest. The law is actually only a slight change to earlier legislation. It made it an offense to knowingly and willfully commit such a crime. But under the trespass bill, latest language chance, however, someone could end up in law enforcement custody for entering an area that they don't realize is Secret Service protected and engages in disorderly or disruptive conduct or impedes or disrupts the orderly conduct of government business or official functions. And the Secret Service serves as the police that protects not just current and former administration or American presidents, but are also dispatched to monitor special events of national significance, a category with a broad cast of qualifiers. In the past, sporting events, state funerals, inaugural addresses, and NATO and G8 summits have been designated as such by the Department of Homeland Security divisions that decide when and where the Secret Service will need to be normal coverage. And this article goes on, but just note that you're really, according to this law, which was passed last year, you're not allowed to protest anywhere that this son of a bitch is speaking, okay, or any schmuck being covered by the Secret Service is speaking anywhere in this country. So you're limited. And this guy, and this is why I really so dislike this man. I mean, hate is a bad word, a politically incorrect word to use, but what I hate this guy is because he's destroyed our entire Constitution. Right?
Well, he just took up where Bush left off.
He just took up and just decimated it. And you know what? No one's doing a damn thing about it. So, yeah, that's what's going on, folks. Anything else about that one?
Yeah, this is interesting. Walmart dispatches one of their head PR guys to write a response to a college student. Walmart, the country's largest private employer and a huge wheeler of political influence, is now taking on their greatest challenge yet, a college junior writing an op-ed in her student newspaper.
Good.
Georgetown University student Aaron Royden wrote a piece for the Hoya, the school's student-run newspaper, in support of the Large Retailer Accountability Act, which would raise the minimum wage for big-box retail employees to $12.50 an hour. To deal with this threat, Walmart dispatched Stephen Restivio, a senior director of communications at Walmart, to write a responding op-ed. To review, the day before the D.C. Council voted on the issue, Walmart threatened to cancel the development of 3 of 6 planned stores in the district, specifically announcing plans to pull out of D.C.'s most economically disadvantaged neighborhoods. Residents were confused. Why would Walmart balk at the idea of paying $12.50 an hour when they had previously promised comparable or higher wages? Luckily, the council ignored Walmart's shenanigans and passed the measure 8-5. Now Mayor Vincent Gray has the opportunity to sign or veto it. Aaron's piece on July 24th pointed out the reasons that many of us want LRAA to become law, to establish a living wage for notoriously underpaid retail workers is one of the most expensive cities in the world. She also points to Walmart's enormous revenue and their previous promise to pay $13 an hour. Perhaps most importantly, she points to the bill's ability to lift Washington, D.C. and families out of poverty. The current minimum wage creates a cycle of poverty where even full-time workers struggle to make a living, then transferring the burden of paying for necessities to the taxpayers. In his July 29th response, Restivio, who we'll mention again, is a senior director of communications at Walmart, responding to a student op-ed in a college newspaper, says that LRAA is bad policy because it doesn't apply to all residents. Workers at places like Starbucks, McDonald's, ExxonMobil, Giant, Applebee's, Safeway, Nike, Banana Republic, Five Guys, and the Apple Store, and hundreds more businesses like them aren't covered. The legislation does not create a level playing field and imposes arbitrary costs on only a handful of businesses in D.C., and that's bad public policy. Presidio is referring in part to the section of LRAA that states, employees are not barred from entering into a written valid collective bargaining agreement waiving provisions of this act if such a waiver is set forth in clear and unambiguous terms. He and other Walmart spokesmen have said this is a discriminatory exemption for unionized retail stores when in fact it's simply a bargaining chip workers can use in collective bargaining negotiations, keeping $12.50 as the wage floor. Not that we're surprised that Walmart spokesman doesn't fully understand unions or the process of management negotiating with workers. In addition, Restivio claims that full-time average wage for Walmart associate in Virginia is $12.39 an hour, and yet he says $12.50 an hour is a living wage in D.C. A more expensive place to live is an arbitrary cost. Refuting Restivio's point by point could be the basis of a much longer post, but the fact remains that Walmart is so desperate, so insecure about their reputation, and so prone to bullying behavior that when a college student writes in an op-ed in a campus newspaper in support of a policy Walmart doesn't like, they just can't resist the urge to launch their PR machine. Don't let bullying rule the day. Tell Mayor Gray to sign LRAA and help lift the District of Columbia families out of poverty.
Yeah, I got.
Can
one.
You imagine that they send a senior communications guy to to write in a college newspaper?
Yeah. I mean, they're so frightened of what's going on. It's unbelievable.
Gee, they might have to pay somebody a living wage. Oh,
so,
and not take home billions for themselves.
They're so frightened of what's happening. Oh, this is interesting here. This is from Alternate. Bombshell. Plutocrats brazenly collude to hurt state economies and screw working people.
Huh.
Illinois fat cats discuss a plan to sabotage state bond ratings and scheme to destroy pensions. Hey, imagine these guys are so evil, so miserably evil bastards. Unbelievable how people can be like this. Right? I sent this over to Larry, by the way.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And for the folks who don't know, Larry Dorman is once a month a guest on our show, and he's public affairs coordinator for AFSCME Council for
I thought he would want to put this up on his posting.
Yeah.
He does a newsletter on council4.org. But these days, many Americans walk around feeling like no matter how hard they work, how much they manage to save, or how carefully they plan for the future, the game is rigged against them.
Yeah.
They suspect that behind closed doors, CEOs and Wall Street honchos are eagerly scheming to rip them off. Their worst fears of corruption and collusion just came true in Illinois, where corporate titans were caught red-handed in the act of rigging the game. Let's step inside a recent gathering of the corporate-backed Union League Club of Chicago, where former Illinois Attorney General Ty Fahner, who now leads a band of plutocrats known as the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago, recently launched into an hour-long diatribe on evils of state pensions. Fahner, a top GOP fundraiser, can't abide the notion that teachers, firefighters, nurses, and other public workers in the state of Illinois can still expect a decent retirement. Not a luxurious retirement, mind you. The average pension is $32,000 a year, and most state employees will not receive Social Security. But even a modest retirement for hard-working people is too much to today's fat cats. Fahner is part of a virulent strain of public raiders and economic crackpots who have become dominant in the Republican Party and increasingly among the Democrats too, who are hell-bent on destroying unions and attacking public employees. All right. Ultimately, They wish to privatize everything and reduce their tax responsibilities down to nothing. That's why Fenner is declared war on pensions and is promoting a pension crisis in order to justify it. He has called for cost of living cuts, raising the retirement age, capping pension earnings, and shifting the cost of pension obligation of teachers to local school districts, many of which are too poor ever to pay. Okay? He styles himself as a savior who wants only to protect the public from debt, when in reality he's a brutal plutocrat who will stop at nothing to line his pockets at public expense and reduce his and his friends' taxes. Illinois has real problems. However, Fenner does desperately hopes that the public will not catch on to the fact that the states are having difficulty paying out pensions because of the lack of revenue caused by a Wall Street-driven financial crisis and a deep recession it set off, regressive taxes, and the myriad bond scams financiers have already inflicted on states, cities, towns, and municipalities, which have triggered funding crises for pensions and other programs. Fenner has tried a number of dirty tricks to attack pensions in his career, but his most recent admission is absolutely breathtaking in its brazenness. He boasts of working to scam the Illinois bond rating. And during Fenner's talk to the Union League Club, an unidentified person in the audience suggested that pressuring credit agencies to rig the state bond ratings in order to attack pensions might be a jolly good idea.
Oh,
well, Fenner briefly replied that he had already thought about that, and his group had tried it. Audience members stated, "Maybe sometimes you've got to be irresponsible to be responsible. If a political solution really doesn't produce a favorable outcome, maybe you need to market a solution. And a solution, and a market solution, I don't mean bankruptcy. I mean actually taking down the state rating even further to the state's bond essentially becomes below investment grade. And it drives up the borrowing cost to the state and all of us to a significant level enough that you really feel the public pressure. What kind of a sadistic son of a bitch, miserable bastard would do this, you know?
Greedy bastard.
I mean, what kind
of
bastard?
How much more money does he want?
What kind of bastard?
Never enough.
Is, And Fenner, the Civic Committee. I'm sorry.
What's his job?
He's the head of the pensions. And the Civic Committee, not me, but me and some of the people that make up the Civic Committee did meet with and call in one case, a person and a couple of calls to Moody's and Fitch and Standard Poor's and say, how in the hell can you guys do this? And Fenner went on to take credit for downgrades to the Illinois credit rating, saying, if you watch what happened in the last few years, it's been steadily down. What a piece of work this guy is. How does he get a job? Check out the video, and there's a video in Arts and Radio. Fenner's Civic Committee helped jaw down state bond ratings. And as the audience members correctly adduced, pushing down the bond ratings is a great way to screw workers, state, and taxpayers. Pension funds buy bonds, often from the state, to stay financially healthy. In order for the pension funds to buy the bond, it must have a passing grade. If the grade is lowered, say, to A, from A to B, the price of the bond goes down, and the pension fund will suffer a loss. If the bond rating is dropped below a minimum standard, then the pension fund must sell the bond and take a much bigger loss. Well, lowering,
that's what he wants to do.
Exactly. Well, lowering the bond rate also has the effect of artificially inflating the interest rates that bondholders must pay on future bonds, making them more expensive to buy and reducing the state's ability to borrow. Well, the basic idea is to manufacture a crisis by financially starving pension funds. And Fenner and company know this will put political pressure on Illinoisans to take away worker pension benefits. In a nutshell, here's what the video reveals. Corporate honchos, some of whom may have invested financial interest in Illinois bonds, feels perfectly comfortable with calling and exerting pressure on rating agencies. Rating agencies are political entities whose supposedly impartial research can be influenced and perhaps even bought.
Is there an audio piece there?
No, unfortunately not. This goes a little bit long, but, you know, it's kind of a, it's really important that you understand. I'm gonna refer people
to this. What a creep that guy is.
Yeah, I want to refer people to this because it's such a horrible thing. This is on alternet.com. And it's on today, let's see, it was actually published on the 29th.
You wonder how many other people in other states are...
Well, you know, you think about Wisconsin, you think about these miserable bastards who, you know, I mean, these people are sick,
they sit around
mean,
just
horrible,
find ways
bastards.
To take pensions
money.
Away from middle-class people.
Yeah, who spent 30 and 40 years and stuff trying to build them up.
And
you know,
contributing into them.
And contributing into them, you know. And they just want to steal their money, these bastards. I hope these guys rot in hell for eternity because there's nothing good.
Even
about.
That sounds too good for them.
Yeah, I mean, they should just die in oblivion. Shouldn't be any afterlife for these guys. This is, let me go to a quick music break, maybe. What do you think?
Okay, yeah, totally.
I'll come back because I want to read this. The White House creates a team to shape Americans' behavior.
Okay, we
got to read this, guys.
We got to save our energy, build up energy.
We'll
take a little music break, get energized, and read this.
We can't stand
just the title of that article makes me sick.
Doesn't it make you crazy to think they're going through that process? You know?
Yep.
So we'll be right back.
Breitbart?
Oh, yeah, Breitbart. Breitbart, Breitbart .com. Breitbart TV, actually, I guess. It's a conservative Fox News, okay, the federal government is hiring what it calls a behavioral insights team that will look for ways to subtly influence people's behavior, according to a document describing the program obtained by FoxNews.com. Critics warn that there could be unintended consequences to such policies, while supporters say the team could make government and society more efficient. While the program is still in its early stages, the document shows that the White House is already working on such projects that, with almost a dozen federal departments and agencies, including the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Agriculture, behavioral sciences can be used to help design public policies that work better, cost less, and help people to achieve their goals. Read the government document describing the program, which goes on to call for applicants to apply for positions on the team. Well, the document was emailed by Maya Shankar, a White House senior advisor on social and behavioral sciences, to a university professor with the request that it be distributed to people interested in joining the team. Well, the idea is that the team would experiment with various techniques with the goal of tweaking behavior so that people do everything from saving more for retirement to saving more in energy costs. And the document praises subtle policies to change behavior that have already been implemented in England, which already has a behavioral insights team. One British policy concerns how to get late tax filers to pay up. And sending letters to late taxpayers that indicate a social norm, i.e. that 9 out of 10 people in Britain paid their taxes on time, resulting in a 15% increase in response rates over a three-month period, rolling out to 30 million euro of, or 30 million pounds of extra annual revenue. The document reads, another policy aimed to convince people to install attic insulation to conserve energy offers an attic clearance service at full cost to people, led to a five-fold increase in their subsequent adoption of attic insulation. So people are brainwashing everybody into doing these things by certain ways. Not exactly saying. Richard Thaler popularized the term nudge, has already been associated with a new program, as one professor who received Shankar's email forwarded to others with a note. Anyone interested in working for the White House in a nudge squad? The UK has one, and it's been extraordinarily successful. Richard Thaler told Fox News that the new program sounds good. I don't know who those people are who would want to such a program, but they must either be misinformed or misguided, he said. The goal is to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of government by using scientific collected evidence to inform policy designs. What is the alternative? The only alternatives I know are hunches, traditions, and ideology, either left or right, but some economists urge caution. I'm very skeptical of a team promoting nudge policies, Michael Thomas, an economist at Utah University, told Fox. Ultimately, nudging assumes a small group of people in government know better about choices than the individuals making them. And sometimes, he adds, that government actually promotes the wrong thing. Trans fats were considered better than saturated and unsaturated fats in the past. This is an error. And every intervention would need to be tested to make sure it works well. And said Harvard professor David Leibson, who studies behavioral economics and is in touch with the people in government setting up the program,
He adds that the exact way the team will function is currently unknown. So, you know, they're trying to nudge people. They're trying to brainwash people. And, you know, we read here a while back about Obama's plan to, you know, he's pumping a lot of money into studying the brain.
Well, I remember. We read
remember
something
that?
About
yeah.
that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't find it on here. I've looked, but... No.
Yeah. No, it's really, really quite frightening, you know?
It is.
Really.
This is a
quote. I always like these kind of quotes. And I've never wasted time trying to explain who you are to people who are committed to misunderstanding you. Somebody named Dream Hampton came up with that one. Interesting. Now, you know, we're on Union Night here, and I think this is very important. This is from Think Progress page, and it says, your Big Mac would only cost 68 cents more if McDonald's doubled its pay. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And it says, if McDonald's were to double its salaries and benefits of all of its employees, from the CEO down to the minimum wage cashiers, it would still only cost an extra 68 cents for a Big Mac, according to a new report. As fast food workers across the country are going on strike to demand a livable wage, University of Kentucky research assistant Arnobio Marlex tells the Huffington Post that it would cost the average consumer mere cents to give them just that. Okay, currently a minimum wage McDonald's employee makes $7.25 an hour. CEO makes $8.75 million. But if the former were raised to $15 and latter to $17.5 million, the dollar menu would only have to become the $1.17 menu, and the Big Mac would go from $3.99 to $4.69. See, I didn't know the Big Mac was that much. I haven't bought one in years.
How much is it?
$3.99.
Oh.
For a Big Mac? Yeah, that's
a big I don't want to interrupt you, but I got onto the site, but there is no there's no audio piece on this one.
Oh, there was no audio piece on it.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. I don't know why.
Maybe because they don't have a flash.
Yeah.
These numbers underscore the low wage workers already know it would take very little for McDonald's to vastly improve the lives of those who make the company run. In fact, minimum wage raises have proven beneficial to companies' bottom line. Current wages for the lowest paid McDonald's workers are unworkable, and even the company knows that. A recent budget released by McDonald's told employees to get by through getting a second job and spending zero on heating. Still, the company leadership has tried to frame itself as a charitable, above minimum wage employer. God, what a joke and what an incredible joke. So anyway, just so you know, guys, it's such a joke. And for an extra 68 cents for a Big Mac, all right?
The workers could be paid a hell of a lot better.
They would be paid double. They could double their wages.
That's pretty good. I won't eat at McDonald's, though. The food is not real.
Oh, it's horrible. But, hey, you know. This is funny. I don't know if anybody knows James Wood, but he was an actor. He's an actor, and he quoted the Republican thinker, honestly, his speechwriters must be smoking crack if they can so callously dismiss Benghazi, Fast and Furious, IRS, NSA, and only God knows what else. As a little quote by, Putin, right, Prime Minister. who says, Barack Obama is either an idiot or he's purposely trying to destroy the American economy.
Oh, listen to this.
You know, that's what he said.
Who said that?
Putin.
What did he say?
He said, Barack Obama is either an idiot or he's purposely trying to destroy the American economy.
That's true. Listen to this.
Yeah.
You know, Jay-Z.
Jay-Z, globalist, Beyonce's
husband. Listen to this.
Moron from hell.
In a newly released interview with Rap Radar's Elliot Wilson, rapper Jay-Z fired back at Harry Belafonte over Belafonte's criticism that he, among other artists, has turned his back on social responsibility. Jay-Z responded, I'm offended by that because, first of all, and this is going to sound arrogant, my presence is charity.
My presence is charity.
Just who I am, just like Obama's is. Obama provides hope when he does, whether he does anything. The hope that he provides for a nation and outside
my
of America
presence,
isn't enough.
My presence
enough.
Is charity.
Oh, my God. God,
the
size of that
asshole.
Guy's
oh,
ego.
My, what an asshole.
I hope no one buys any of his records or his
wife. Jay-Z and Beyonce, my presence is charity.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Make me puke, make me vomit. Okay. Any other wonderful words, wherever that is? My presence is charity, says Jay-Z.
When the Wiener scandal first broke at the end of May 2011, then Representative Anthony Weiner claimed that his social media accounts had been hacked. The left seized on Andrew Breitbart as the likely culprit. In a new report, the New York Daily News suggests that Weiner's campaign had actually spent $45,000 at least on private investigations to find the non-existent hacker.
Yeah, he's such a wiener.
Oh, isn't he?
Isn't he a wiener? Yeah. Says, I used to pray for somebody to speak out, to stand up and defend our liberties. Then I realized, I am somebody. I like this. You know, it's interesting. There was in the Egyptian protests, somebody actually put on it, it says, to the U.S. policymakers, get your dirty hands out of Egypt. It says, we love the American people. That was really good. To U.S. policymakers, get your dirty hands out of Egypt. To all the American people, we got nothing but love for you.
Oh.
And from the Egyptian people. This was a sign in the protests. I think that was interesting. Hey, keep your hands out of us. Out of our country. I love this so much. This is something. I forgot who it was that said this. We love atheism's photo. It said, and they got a whole bunch of drowning people, right? It said, for God so loved the world that he drowned everyone in it. Except for eight people that incestuously repopulated the whole world. I thought that was so fun. I had to post that. Oh, God. Never give up on a dream just because of the time it will take to accomplish it. The time will pass anyway. I love this stuff. Here, somebody sent this to me in the Fed group. It says, you've got a picture of Ron Paul with his hand over his head and butt. Let me get this straight. People who have taken an oath to defend the Constitution are attacking me for it, for defending the Constitution. Yeah. Here's an interesting one. I don't know if anybody's interested in marijuana laws or anything like that, but a very interesting article about marijuana cures methadone and heroin addiction. It does it for all opiates. I can already feel, I'm just going to read this. This is from Salem-News.com. I can already feel the first comment. What the hell is he talking about? Well, okay. During the 1860s, cannabis marijuana was used in the U.S. to get addicted people off alcohol, tobacco, and opium, and it was very successful in doing so. Many Civil War veterans were addicted to all three of these. At about the same time, morphine and hypodermic syringe were invented, which gave doctors real control of pain and brought about the concept that a physician's first obligation to his patient was to control pain. It was far nicer and safer than opium or alcohol. And the chemist went to work on opium and synthesized many different compounds, several of which were found to be more powerful and more addicting than morphine, the original opiate. And these more powerful drugs were oxycodone, hydrocodone, belladid, and heroin, which is diadexomorphine. Codeine, another opiate, was a much weaker opiate, and its use has been minimal in the face of much stronger opiates. But with weak advertising and mouth-to-ear gossip, with heavy advertising and mouth-to-ear gossip, patients demanded with stronger opiates. And this brought on a real problem for physicians, and give the patient the strong opiates, or they will find another doctor who will. And these strong opiates are notorious for not only causing addictions, but they can easily cause death for accidental overdose or suicide, which are in the thousands. So doctors will give you enough to turn you into an addict, 20 pills. Then they say no, but the patient is still in pain. So the patient changes doctors and repeats the action. And soon they realize it is easier to get drugs on the street. The state medical boards have jumped into this mess by ordering physicians to stop writing these strong opiate prescriptions. What is a patient to do about this? In the states where it is legal, patients have switched to marijuana for severe pain, and in Oregon, 90% of patients use marijuana for pain. And imagine that, Lila.
Wow.
And marijuana has been proven to not be addictive, though many say the lifestyle certainly is. In states where marijuana is not legal as an option, they are either buying strong opiates on the black market or using heroin, and this is causing a tsunami of overdose deaths. The New York Times had a story on 7/19/2013 of an epidemic of heroin deaths in New England.
Wow.
He said getting heroin was cheaper than going to a doctor to get a prescription for the pain meds that they are addicted to. Or that they had simply been denied a legal prescription, so they turned to the streets and found heroin. No, heroin cannot be prescribed by doctors in the United States. It is only found on the black market. In the state of Maine, which has the lowest population per capita in the nation, there are few doctors available in the rural areas. But there are heroin dealers aplenty. It is a vicious cycle, to be sure. And there is presently a movement in the Association of State Medical Boards to further restrict the use of strong opiates. There are three possible scenarios about this. More heroin use and deaths. The evidence in the newspapers is that people are ignoring the severe hazards of heroin. Buying real or fake strong opiates, or hopefully, you know, using marijuana for pain, whether it's legal or not. And many heroin and strong painkiller addicts have been put on methadone, which is just as addicting and deadly as morphine. It has caused hundreds of deaths.
Oh, it's terrible stuff.
Yeah. Marijuana is the best and safest painkiller. Using alcohol to replace pain meds is a common solution. Many turn to legally just to find it as destructive as any black market drug out there. Right? So, you know, marijuana is a painkiller, guys. And, you know, it's got to be legalized. It's got to be legalized everywhere.
Yeah, and I think it will be. It's just a matter of time.
It's going. I mean, you know, people believe in it. I was reading an article today that said baby boomers are you know, retirees and stuff are going through it because it's painful.
Yeah.
You know, and they can get it and they remember it.
And there's no side effects.
And it's being legalized everywhere, and they're using it everywhere. So.
It just makes sense.
Yeah. And this, I mean, just in case, I mean, we're over. But Hawaii is offering homeless residents a one-way flight off the islands.
I know, isn't that awful?
It's so sick. But anyway, folks, we're over the show. I hope you enjoyed it. And now, join me tonight. When we talk about a lot more stuff.
Take care.
Take care.
And have a good night, folks. I'll talk to you next week. Good night.